Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Augustine Burroughs, whose new book is This Is How: How to Survive What You Think You Can't. Historian Aaron Greenwald, editor of A Company Man, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies, a memoir by Marc-Antoine Caillot, describes the lost and found history of a fascinating manuscript. Augustine Burroughs is the New York Times best-selling writer who's the author of Running with Scissors, Dry, Magical Thinking, You Better Not Cry, and the novel Cellavision, which is currently being made into a feature film. His most recent book is an amazing collection of essays called This Is How: Surviving What You Can't. We're very excited he's coming to New Orleans on May 3rd. Augustine Burroughs, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, I know you've gotten married recently. Congratulations and best wishes.
Thank you. Yeah, I did. I got married, and it's what they say, you know, in the best possible case is to marry your best friend. So that's what I ended up doing.
Well, I saw it in the New York Times, so felicitations. And I noticed there's nothing in This Is How about throwing a wedding. So how was that?
No, it's, you know, This Is How is really a compilation. It's about how to survive the things that you think you can't. And the genesis of the book was really from, you know, I mean, I've written so many memoirs about my childhood living with my mentally ill mother and her even more mentally ill and disbarred psychiatrist. And there was, you know, sexual abuse as a child and abandonment. And then later there was alcoholism and drug use and on and on. And, you know, the question I get more often than any other is, how did you survive that? Fill in the blank. And, you know, the truth is that I am a survivor, and I'm very good at, unfortunately or fortunately, at surviving adversity. I've encountered a lot of it in my life, and I've made numerous messes on my own, and I've been able to work through those. And this book is about, you know, how to get through the things you think you won't have to get through, or the things you think you can't possibly survive, or changing your life in a really dramatic, meaningful way when you just don't think that's possible.
Do you really think that we can make permanent fixes, or do you think they're all temporary and battles that have to be refought every day?
No, I know for a fact we can make permanent fixes because I've done that. I mean, the book is not an academic book. You know, it's not something that I've culled from years of research. It's created from years of experience. I mean, everything in the book works for me. And, you know, as my memoirs have shown me over the years, I'm a lot like other people. We're all very, very, very similar. If you put our political or theological beliefs aside, we all pretty much want the same things. And I don't think it's necessarily easy to make permanent, lasting changes, but I don't think it has to be easy. You know, I mean, I think that easy is one of those things that it's overrated. There's nothing wrong with something being very difficult to do. And that's really what the book is about. It's about manifesting this change in your life and being able to see that progress. One of the things that I talk about is confidence, because so many people wish they had more confidence. But I just sort of ask, well, what is confidence? Apparently, I'm very confident when I'm on stage. I don't have a stage phobia. I'm not afraid to talk in front of thousands of people. So what is that? And I've observed myself when I'm on stage, and I don't have some extra special part called confidence. There's no blood confidence level. You can go to your doctor and have them boost your blood confidence level by eating more asparagus. Confidence is really the absence of something that you have too much of, which is caring too much about what other people think. So to be more confident, you've got to be much less aware of other people and more focused on exactly the thing you're doing in the moment.
Now, one of the things that you've mastered that I know will appeal to New Orleanians is you have that great combination of humor and darkness. It seems like even in dark, dark moments, you are able to find something funny.
Yeah, I've experienced things in my life that were just so atrocious, so sort of off the chart awful, that you either hang yourself or you find the humor in it. I mean, it goes one way or the other. And I am a survivor by nature, I suppose. So humor has been a life raft. You can hang on to humor and sort of float yourself out of the shark-infested waters until you're on safer ground. And I think that, you know, just in general, I don't believe that anyone can achieve sort of a state of permanent, constant happiness. I think there's always going to be elements, you know, of darkness or sadness in your life. And they can sit side by side, you know, within you. And I talk about this in the book. I don't have children, but I imagine the worst thing that can happen to a person is the death of a child. And I met a woman who experienced such a thing. And it was many years later, and she was a happy person who, at a moment, if you just asked the right question, tears would spring into her eyes. That grief was always with her. And yet, she was able to eventually incorporate her horrific loss into her life. And of course, it didn't get better, and nothing ever fixed it. But to her surprise, she ended up being a happy person who lived with unhappiness and loss, et cetera. So it's, you know, trying not to become a prisoner of the past when horrible things happen to us. We don't get to live inside them forever and become prisoners of our past. We have to incorporate them and move on into the future.
In that chapter about how to feel less regret, because I know so many people who feel so much regret, you have that wonderful line about how even the most terrible loss doesn't have to make you darker, it can make you deeper.
Well, that's really true. Earlier, you know, when I was in my 20s, I experienced a loss that I did not feel was survivable. And there was absolutely a point when I could have gone deeper and deeper and darker and down, down, down that sort of rabbit hole of despair, but I did not. I came close, but I did not do that. And what I find now many years later is that, I mean, I definitely have a greater degree of depth from that experience. And I'm not darker as a result of it. I'm not stuck in a state of permanent ruination. But, you know, I absolutely know what that feels like.
Well, you know, a lot of people say that Americans particularly, that we have a compulsion to fix things, that we have this yearning for self-improvement and self-perfection, and we pop pills and we think we're depressed, when really we're just sad, and sadness has a kind of place in life as well.
Sadness does have a place in life, and it can be very uncomfortable to be sad because, you know, our media, when we turn on the television, you know, barring a catastrophe on the news, it's a lot of advertising images. It's a lot of very colorful, happy, upbeat stuff. Morning talk shows are always very upbeat. Evening talk shows are upbeat and funny. So I think when we feel sad, we feel like, okay, so I am the apple in the crate of oranges. You know, this isn't right. This isn't compatible with sort of modern American life. But of course it is, because so many people feel many different things. You know, they do feel sad. They feel depressed. They feel isolated. They feel alone. And, you know, the greatest privilege, and it has been such an incredible privilege to be an author and to have had the opportunity to meet so many people all over the world, is to find how deeply, deeply, deeply similar we are in terms of what we feel and our insecurities and, you know, the things that we fear. I can't tell you how many times I've spoken to somebody who's taken me aside and he or she has shared something personal that's just very difficult for them to even admit. And I just wish I could, you know, magically introduce them to the other 1, 2, 3, 4,000 people I've met who has said the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so that commonality, I think, which is one of the reasons I think people enjoy reading memoir, is it can make you feel more connected. And any reading experience does that. You know, if it's a good book, you know, you feel connected. But with memoir, you know, you feel connected to an actual person, not a creation. And, you know, I think what I'm trying to do with this is how is to just teach people how they can cut themselves some slack. It's like you said, you know, we are tinkerers and we do like to fix things. And I actually admire that. I mean, we joke a lot about, you know, we're a self-help culture. But I don't think that's a terrible thing. You know, I think that level of sort of emotional ambition, that desire to be, oh, we're fine, but couldn't we be better? I think that's a really admirable thing. And I think it's one of the reasons that our country is as strong as it is.
So what was the most difficult essay for you to write?
Well, you know, there was one chapter about suicide, because it's something I had not written about in my previous books to any extent. And that was that when I was a young teenager, I was planning on killing myself. And the reason for that is because my circumstances seemed hopeless. Even if I survived my living situation, this was a period of my life when my mother had given me away and I was living with her psychiatrist in his house with his extended family of biological kids and psychiatric patients. It was absolutely outside of normal, you know, society. I just felt that this was ruinous and that I would never be able to fit in. So I began to focus on and think about how I was going to kill myself. And I went through the steps in my mind and I found a technique and I prepared myself. And I realized, it was sort of an epiphany, that if I do this, I'm not actually going to experience the benefits, the alleged benefits of suicide, peace, freedom, release from problems, because all of those things require human living tissue. You know, you need to have a brain to feel relief. You need to be alive to feel free. And if the process of killing oneself, if the actual slitting of the wrist, you know, or forgive me for being so graphic, but if the swallowing of the pill, if there was any relief at all in that act, there would be no suicide because people would stop right there. So the process of killing oneself doesn't free us, then what does? Where are we going to feel it? And I realized that what I wanted was not actually to kill myself, but to end my life. And that I could do. You can step out of your life, no matter how terrible it is. Now, of course, the consequences can be just terrible with that, but you can do that. And you don't always realize that you can do that. You don't realize if you are a mother and you've got two children and you know for a fact you are going to put your head in the gas oven tonight and kill yourself, you can pad down the hallway barefoot in your bathrobe and walk out your front door and make a left and get on a bus. There are ways, extreme ways, to step out of your life. Now, of course, you don't always have to be that drastic, but if it's between death, suicide, ending your life, you know, your physical body life, or stepping out of your life and ending your life as you know it, I think the latter is better because, you know, if you think about if your life feels hopeless to you, oh, I know from experience, it's because your life is simply too small. This is an enormous, enormous world. Of course, there are exceptions, and I think there are certain terminal diseases which are physically unbearable, which, you know, a person may feel they want to exit before the symptoms get worse, but that's a different sort of issue altogether.
Very much so. Now, one of the things you said that I thought was so enchanting was that you had a vision for how you wanted this book to look after readers had it for a while.
My hope is that a person will buy it and read it, and then it's like a reference, you know, sitting in their library or sitting on their table or sitting near their bed. When something happens, they can go back to that section and read through. You know, the book is really the same thing over and over again in many different ways, and that is about reaching the actual truth of your circumstances. And the truth can be buried behind the thing you think is true or everyone tells you is true. So you may not even think to look deeper. You know, it's like when I was abandoned by my mother at a very, very young age to her psychiatrist. I was a little boy and I literally felt that I would die. I thought, little kids need their moms. I'm going to die from this. And I was so stunned after the second and third night to find myself alive. I thought more about it, and I thought, well, I guess I'm not going to die. And that's when I realized a brutal truth about parents, about being a child. Parents are a luxury. And the fact that I did not have parents did not mean I was destined or doomed to die. It meant that it wasn't ideal, and it meant that I didn't get to have the thing I wanted and the thing everyone should have, but oh well. You know, oh well.
Oh well, indeed. Oh, well, we're so glad. We're glad you survived. We're glad you've written all these books. And I think people are going to love this book. I know it made me think harder, look a little deeper. It gave me a lot to think about.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that so much. Oh, it does. I really hope it does.
Well, you can meet Augustine Burroughs when he signs This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't, May 3rd at 6 o'clock at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Augustine.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
The Historic New Orleans Collection is known for preserving and at times rescuing bits of our city's history. And they've just published a new book that sheds extraordinary light on the colonial era. It's called A Company Man, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies, a memoir by Marc-Antoine Caillot. Written in 1730, the manuscript was lost, then recently rediscovered. Terry Chalmers translated it from the French, and Historic New Orleans Collection curator and historian Aaron Greenwald edited the manuscript. Aaron is here today to talk about this amazing journey of this book. Aaron, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on this gorgeous book.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to work on it.
It's so irresistible. You look at it and you just have to pick it up.
It is. You know, our book designer deserves some credit, Allison Cody, for making sure that the book was aesthetically very pleasing. But I think people will find what's between its covers to be quite interesting in terms of Louisiana history as well.
So tell us about this manuscript's journey from centuries ago to us today.
Well, sure. So the manuscript's author was here in the 1720s. He left in 1731 as a clerk for the French Company of the Indies. And you're probably very familiar with the Dutch East India Company and the English East India Company. Well, the French had a company as well, and theirs was globally active, including here in Louisiana. And we suspect that the clerk wrote this manuscript. He began it probably while he was staying here at an inn on Royal Street, owned by a couple named Louis and Anne Jarry. It was a place that was very popular with ship's officers and other company administrators. And we suspect he started it here, may have spent some time on it while he was on the ship, the Saint-Louis, going back to France in May of 1731. And my feeling is that he probably finished the manuscript between the time that he arrived back in France and the time that he received his next commission, this time to India, later that year. So I suspect that the manuscript was completed probably before he left in 1732 for Pondicherry.
And this was really a young man's job, wasn't it?
And, oh, absolutely.
And not a particularly desirable one at the time.
No, you know, you had to start somewhere with the Company of the Indies and work your way through the hierarchy. And the clerkship positions were really entry-level positions for people who had patronage relationships, perhaps, with members of the nobility or people who were in the upper ranks of the Ministry of the Marine. And Caillot did have ties. He had ties to the Maison du Roi, which is the royal household of the king. And he had ties to this Maison du Roi through his father and likely received the position as a patronage position.
What an adventuresome life he had, though.
It really was an adventuresome life. You know, he started here. He was here for 2 years, and you're right. A clerkship was not the most desirable, but a clerkship in Louisiana was probably the least of all of the desirable places for a clerk to come because there wasn't a lot of opportunity for people to make money on the side.
So the manuscript was written and was lost.
Correct. The manuscript was written likely for a very small circle of his intimates, family, friends, probably reading circles within the Company of the Indies. It was not intended for a general audience. And we know this because it never would have gotten past the censors. A lot of the content is highly critical of the French Company of the Indies, and in particular, some of the ship's captains that were on the circuit between France and Louisiana. And so we know that he wrote it for a small circle, which wasn't too unusual, especially for travelogues during this period. And it's unclear where it's been exactly for the last 200 years. It resurfaced in the 1930s, actually in Canada. It may have been left with a convent of Augustinian nuns in Malestroit, France. It's in Brittany. It's just a short distance away from the company's home port of Lorient, which is on the Brittany coast. And during Caillot's time, that particular convent was home to a group of Ursuline nuns, and they ran a hospital for ship's officers and administrators, people who had some money, who were coming back from the Indies, who were coming back from America and needed time to recover after their long and sometimes very difficult voyage. So he may have left it there. I don't think he brought it with him into India, but it's not clear. I'm waiting for someone else to pick up that trail.
And when did these Historic New Orleans Collection acquire it?
The collection acquired the manuscript in 2004, and the work of translation began. Obviously, our work was interrupted in 2005, and the real work of translation began when they hired Terry Chalmers in March of 2006.
What shape was it in? What did the manuscript look like?
The manuscript is beautiful. It's very clean. We're very, very fortunate that Kaya was a clerk, and clerks have good handwriting.
Absolutely.
It's one of the only requirements of being a clerk, that and being literate, obviously. And so the manuscript itself is in pretty much pristine condition. There were some tears, rips, and water stains to some of the watercolors. There are 13 different watercolors that he includes.
And they're exquisite, aren't they?
They really are. I mean, they're quite fabulous. But overall, the condition of the manuscript is very, very clean.
And what do you think it tells us about that period in our history?
Well, I think, surprisingly, it tells us that the 18th century certainly wasn't a stuffy period. And when you look at Kaya's account of the Lundi Gras celebration, it's the first documented carnival celebration recorded in a history, things haven't changed that much. You know, men were still cross-dressing on Mardi Gras. Lots of drinking, lots of dancing, lots of wonderful music being played. So in some ways, it's striking to see how little has changed. But in other ways, obviously, you know, it's really an important window on a world that was inhabited not exclusively by Europeans, and in fact, not even mainly by Europeans, but by very large populations of Native Americans,
goes into such detail about the Native Americans.
He does go into such detail. And, you know, one of the reasons the manuscript is so important is it gives us another account of the Natchez War, which mm-hmm. began in 1729 and was really the reason for the company's withdrawal from the colony in 1731. And he adds his voice to what we already know about that incident and tells us what it was like to be in the city of New Orleans when people were coming back from the horrors of Natchez.
And at the same time, with all the serious subject matter, with all this keen observation, he has this incredibly fresh and funny voice at times.
He's a very, very playful writer. He's very concerned with not boring his audience. Several times he stops himself and says, you know, I'm not going to tell you any more details because I'm afraid I'm going to bore the reader. And I think his primary concern is to entertain. He's very interested in being perceived as funny and clever. He gets into some hijinks. He's constantly chasing women.
Absolutely.
He's very, very much a ladies' man, and that comes through. In fact, those are the portions of the manuscript, the personal parts of the manuscript, that I think are most fascinating. You get a sense of what it was like to flirt in the 18th century. And it's different from the parts of the manuscript that are more formulaic, that included things like, you know, descriptions of fish and native plants and trees. So there was this Enlightenment push to include topics of scientific or pseudoscientific value. And he does that as well. But I think what's best about it is when he talks about his own personal experiences.
And he's always confessing to overindulging in Bacchic liqueur.
That's right. That's right. He did not spare himself many pleasures, I don't think. He was a gambler. He, you know, enjoyed food and drink. And as I mentioned before, he was quite a fan of the ladies.
And you're working on a longer study of the Company of the Indies.
I am.
How does this feed into that work?
Well, you know, it's been such a wonderful project to work on. And my longer study does deal with the French Company of the Indies in both the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean worlds. And what I've done is I've used Kaya's story as a sort of narrative backbone to take the reader from place to place while also giving them many, many more details about the African slave trade, the textile industry in the 18th century, and how people circulated throughout the Atlantic and Indian Ocean worlds.
We'll look forward to that. Work hard.
Great, I will.
Congratulations on this wonderful piece of work. We've been talking with Aaron Greenwald, editor of A Company Man, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies, a memoir by Marc-Antoine Caillot. You can meet Aaron when she discusses and signs A Company Man, Tuesday, May 7th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Bill Lofelm signs The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, April 30th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Emily Clark signs The Strange History of the American Quadroon, Tuesday, April 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Ellen Kanner, the Meatless Monday blogger for Huffington Post, signs Feeding the Hungry Ghost, Life, Faith, and What to Eat for Dinner, A Satisfying Diet for Unsatisfying Times, Wednesday, May 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. Gary Arnold discusses and signs Go Ahead and Die, Wednesday, May 1st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Tad Hills signs his children's books, Goose Needs a Hug and How Rocket Learned to Write a Story, Thursday, May 2nd at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Augustine Burroughs, signs This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't, Friday, May 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Mary Palmer, an English teacher and author of numerous works of fiction, discusses the art of perseverance at the Fiction Writers Group Monday, May 6th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library. Historian Larry Powell, author of The Accidental City, and Richard Campanella, author of Bienville's Dilemma, appear Monday, May 6th at 7:15 p.m. as part of the Black Widow Literary Salon at Crescent City Books. Today's guest, Aaron Greenwald, signs A Company Man, the remarkable French Atlantic voyage of a clerk for the Company of the Indies, a memoir by Marc-Antoine Caillot, Tuesday, May 7th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses The Lion Is In by Delia Ephron, Tuesday, May 7th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Winona Hodder signs Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, Tuesday, May 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. And don't forget to visit the book tent, sponsored by the New Orleans Gulf South Booksellers at Jazz Fest. It's located next to the CD tent. Proceeds benefit literacy projects in New Orleans. Here's who's signing. Thursday, May 2nd, Ron Thibodeau signs Hell or High Water, How Cajun Fortitude Withstood Hurricanes Rita and Ike from 12 to 1. John Swenson signs New Atlantis, Musicians Battle for the Survival of New Orleans from 1 to 2. Ben Sandmail signs Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans from 2 to 3. Lauren Godin signs New Orleans Chef's Table from 3 to 4. And Jay Massa signs Up Front and Center from 5:30 to 6. And Friday, May 3rd, Chris Champagne signs the Yat Dictionary from noon to 1. Cornell Landry signs The Adventures of Mardi Gras Beat Dog from 1 to 2. Bill Lofelm signs Devil in Her Way from 3 to 4. Saturday, May 4th, Ken Foster signs I'm a Good Dog from 1 to 2. Tom Piazza signs Southern Journey of Alan Lomax from 2 to 3. Keith Spira signs Groove Interrupted from 3 to 4. Kid Chef Eliana signs Cool Kids Cook Louisiana from 4 to 5. Diane de las Casas signs The Little Red Hen from 5 to 6. On Sunday, May 5th, Kevin Bozant signs Quaint Essential New Orleans from 1 to 2. David Spielman signs When Not Performing from 2 to 3. The folks from WWOZ sign their cookbook That Sounds Good from 4 to 5. And Earl Hampton signs The Streetcar Guide to New Orleans from 5 to 6. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.